KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Speak for Peace, Thursday, September 21st at the HI Portland Hawthorne Hostel in Portland. Speak for Peace is a workshop that aims to develop the skills necessary to have constructive conversations when confronted with polarizing topics while recognizing and gracefully engaging with cultural differences. Again, that's Speak for Peace, Thursday, September 21st at 6 p.m. at the HI Portland Hawthorne Hostel, 3031 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. My name is Per Fograng, and the show is Fight the Empire. And my guest today is Alfred McCoy, a professor of history and writer. And back in 1972, he published a groundbreaking work, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, which the CIA tried to censor. But we're going to talk about his most recent book. It just came out just a few days ago, called In the Shadows of the American Century. So, Professor Alfred McCoy, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me on, Per.
Well, this is we are in the middle of a membership drive, so I want to remind people that this book is available for a, I'm not sure what the contribution would be, but it is available if you call 877-500-5266, and we're kind of going to run through, we're going to end the show about 6 minutes before 10 o'clock, and then there'll be a little membership drive talk, and we'll see how we are doing. So we will run straight through until then. So Professor McCoy, you kind of grew up with the American century, didn't you?
Yes, I was born in 1945, which was really the start of America's rise to unprecedented global power and wealth. Back in the day, we called ourselves a great superpower, we called ourselves a world leader, but what we really were in retrospect was the most powerful, the wealthiest empire in human history. And sadly, if from some perspectives, you might say, that empire appears to be coming to an end. And that's not just my view. That's the view of the U.S. National Intelligence Council, the supreme analytic body of the intelligence community in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get onto that near the end, but I'd like to talk about when you were researching your book, you were actually CIA mercenaries trying to knock you out.
Yeah, when I was a graduate student, 26 years old at Yale University, there were reports in the press of heroin being widely used by American soldiers in South Vietnam. And this was shocking because at that time, heroin was a drug of the very poorest in the inner cities of America, not something you'd expect for the American fighting man and woman, certainly. And so it was a shock. But although there were reports about the heroin being spreading rapidly, very rapidly, in the ranks of the U.S. forces, we later learned that 34% of all the soldiers serving in South Vietnam in 1971 were heavy heroin users. In other words, a third of the U.S. Army in South Vietnam were heroin addicts, were junkies. But nobody knew where it was coming from, well, you know, how and why. And there are all kinds of wild rumors about the communists doing it to destroy the U.S. Army from within. So I got a contract from a book publisher, now HarperCollins in New York, to write a book and to try and figure this out. And I started in the Yale Library. I was a library rat back in the day. And very quickly, I ran out of answers to that question, who and how. And so I started hopscotching across the United States, and I went around the world. I clocked 30,000 miles going around the world. Went to Hong Kong, studied the syndicates there, courtesy of the British Narcotics Police, the British Colonial Narcotics Police. I went to Saigon. I explored the trafficking in the upper ranks of the South Vietnamese military, officers connected to the president, vice president, and prime minister of South Vietnam were in control of the traffic. And I went up into Laos, hiked into the hills of Laos, into Hmong villages that grew the opium, and told me that they got their opium to market on the helicopters of Air America, which was an airline owned by the CIA. And in the midst of that inquiry, some Hmong militia, under the direct command of the CIA, ambushed myself and my party. Fortunately, the villager I was doing my research had given me five militiamen armed with rifles to protect us, and there was a bit of a shootout, and we managed to get away. And that was the beginning of the CIA's attempt to block my research, and ultimately, the head of the CIA's covert operations, when the book was in press in New York, paid a personal call upon my publisher, who was a friend, and told him that my book was a threat to national security and it should be suppressed. The CIA demanded and got the right to prior review. Fortunately, the famous journalist Seymour Hersh, the very day that the CIA picked up the manuscript for review, published a front-page article on the New York Times, actually it was the very next day, of the New York Times, saying that this was unprecedented, that the CIA was attempting to censor an American publication prior to publication. And that firestorm of publicity made the CIA back down, and the book was published. But more importantly, for the current book, what that whole experience taught me, it plucked me out of the Yale Library, and it sent me around the world, and it launched me into an inquiry into the nature of American power, particularly the distinctive dimension of American global power that separates, that distinguishes our empire from any other empire before in human history. Ours was an empire that was based on the exercise of its power covertly through the CIA, the NSA, and the intelligence community. And it set me off on what has been a 50-year process of trying to understand this subtle, secret U.S. exercise of global power. And it was an amazing experience, plunging me right into it. By the time I was done with that book, Politics of Heroin, I discovered that although I was living in a democracy, every single aspect of my life was subject to state security control. My phone was tapped by the FBI. My income tax was audited by the IRS, even though my income was poverty-level, graduate student, you know, dirt poor, poorest of the poor. You know, audits are reserved usually for high-flying executives or financiers. The grant I had to study language from the Department of Education was investigated. My sources in Southeast Asia were threatened. Old friends of mine who had gone from college into the intelligence community suddenly appeared magically at my side. I was deeply suspicious. We hadn't seen each other in 4 years. Suddenly, a guy I knew in college 4 years before appears at my side in a bookstore, you know, all smiling and ready to be ever so friendly and wanting to talk about me, my book, my research, what's going on. You know, every aspect of my life, my phone, my graduate fellowship, my friends, my sources, is being pressured by the CIA. It was an extraordinary experience.
Wow, and now they have all kinds of Facebook and the internet and wow. Well, you know, central to your book is the whole idea of the world island. Let's talk about that.
Sure. One of the things about American power, okay, Americans today, we've been on top of the world now, what, about 70 years. We're the third generations of America to inherit this unprecedented power. And we have no idea about how it was built, where it came from, and what its foundation is. And one of the things that distinguishes the U.S. global power, the U.S. empire, is we're the first empire in 1,000 years to capture what one British historian has called the axial ends of the Eurasian landmass. Now, back in 1904, a British geographer named Sir Halford Mackinder, who was then director of the London School of Economics, gave a lecture at the Royal Geographical Society, and he said that Asia, Europe, and Africa were not three separate continents. They were virtually a unified landmass that he called the World Island. And then he pointed to something that was historic. The Trans-Siberian Railway was just about completing its construction, crossing that vast Eurasian landmass from Moscow to all the way across Siberia to Vladivostok. And the only thing that really separated Europe and Asia from each other, which are in fact a single continent, the only reason they're considered two continents is because of that vast empty space in the center. Suddenly, that space was being crossed, that continent was being unified. And Sir Halford Mackinder said that when a power arises that captures the center of this vast world island, then the empire of the world will be in sight. In other words, a new empire will rise to challenge, of course, the British Empire, which was then maritime and which had a navy of 300 ships and 30 naval bastions encircling that same Eurasian landmass. And after World War II, we succeeded Britain, but we were even more powerful because we captured what an Oxford historian has called the axial ends of the Eurasian landmass. Through the NATO alliance established in 1949, we forged an axial point of control in Western Europe. And then in 1951, we signed 4 mutual security pacts down the Pacific littoral, running with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia, that gave us the other axial end. And we, between these two axial points, which were strengthened with a massive array of air bases and naval bases, we then laid layers or circles of steel ringing the Eurasian landmass. First, those mutual security pacts that ran from NATO to the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization and into those 4 pacts with Australia, Japan, the Philippines, etc. Then the fleets. We had the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean, the 7th Fleet in the Western Pacific, and then later on in the 1990s, the 5th Fleet in the Persian Gulf. And our most recent circle of steel that we've laid between those axial points was over the last 10 years, we have built 60 drone bases that stretch from Sicily in the west all the way around Eurasia to Guam Island in the Western Pacific. And these are the layers of power. This is the architecture of power that underlays, that is the substrate for U.S. global hegemony, U.S. global power. And it's a structure of power that's beginning to crumble, actually.
Well, isn't it true that for most of human history, the great powers of the world were located in Asia, and it was kind of around in the 1400s when the Portuguese began navigating the oceans that European empires began to rise. So that's kind of like a 500-year history, which seems to be running its course.
Yeah, that was in that famous lecture that Sir Halford Mackinder gave back in January of 1904. That was his essential point, is that there are sort of 2 key points in modern human history. One, in the 1500s, when Europe began sailing around the Eurasian landmass, that gave the maritime powers, England, Holland, Portugal, Spain, the superiority of maneuver over the great hordes, the Mongols, the Berbers, the Arabs, that were coming out of the heartland, out of the center of the Eurasian landmass or its rim land in Arabia and North Africa. And he said that was the first turning point in human history. And he said now, with the construction of the Trans-Siberian Railway and the unification of Eurasia into this functioning world island, we're now about to witness a second turning point in world history. And, you know, Mackinder's theory was actually tested. One of his most best-known American acolytes was Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the national security advisor to President Jimmy Carter. And Brzezinski was a Polish immigrant aristocrat and very much an intellectual acolyte of Mackinder. In his books on geopolitics, he cites Mackinder a lot. And by the way, Mackinder's 1904 lecture that I talked about is the origin of geopolitics. That lecture is what starts the study of geopolitics. And so, in effect, Brzezinski tested Mackinder to see if he could work. And what Brzezinski did was he got the CIA, got him $100 million under President Carter, and he used radical Islam as kind of a spear or a wedge, driving it from Afghanistan through Soviet Central Asia right into that heartland. And then Brzezinski accomplished his objective. Several thousand miles to the west in Eastern Europe, the satellite states of Eastern Europe were sheared away from the Soviet Empire. So by applying Mackinder to the actual politics, Brzezinski accomplished something extraordinary. He broke up the Soviet Empire. He liberated Eastern Europe, and he was very proud of that accomplishment.
At great cost.
He was, in 1998, Osama bin Laden and radical Islam is beginning to rise. He gave an interview to a French magazine, and they said, isn't there a considerable cost to this? And Brzezinski fired back. He said, what's more important in the history of the world, the liberation of Eastern Europe or a few stirred-up Muslims?
Wow.
That was his phrase. So he was unapologetic. But it works. Now, that has, if Mackinder was right, and Brzezinski's practical application of it, and not all of us get a chance to actually play geopolitics, if that worked, then what we're looking at today is something very, very important. And also what we don't fully appreciate is what I call the geopolitical genius of President Barack Obama. Because although he didn't study Mackinder the way Brzezinski did, he still applied geopolitics to deal with the most fundamental challenge facing the United States as a global power, the rise of China. And we can talk about that, Per, if you want to.
Well, one thing I'd like to say is that when the United States took over a continent, they acquired a huge amount of natural resources, oil, which is very cheap in the old days, plus the labor of slaves and everything. And so that kind of really jump-started the U.S. empire, which the oil is kind of, the cheap oil is gone. And so The heartland, Asia, the Eurasia, still has quite a bit of reasonably priced oil. They have 75% of the world's population and resources. And so it's like the U.S. kind of shot its wad, so to speak. And now the world island has been waiting, and they're coming into their own. You talk about the Trans-Siberian Railway. China's building railroads all over the place. They're shipping goods from China to Portugal, I believe.
Yeah, about 10 years ago, China began using the profits of its international trade, primarily its export trade to the United States, to launch what very quickly became a $1 trillion investment in realizing Halford Mackinder's vision by actually, first of all, laying down a grid of high-speed rails in China and then doing long-distance transcontinental rail shipments from China all the way to Western Europe, particularly to Germany for high-value goods. But most importantly of all, what China has laid down is a transcontinental network of oil and gas pipelines, bringing that oil and gas reserves that you mentioned from Central Asia, Kazakhstan and others, and Siberia, not just westward into Europe, where it fuels Europe's energy and industry and heats the homes, but eastward towards China. And there's now a transcontinental grid of oil pipelines stretching from the Atlantic all the way to Pacific that are lighting Chinese homes and fueling Chinese industries coming from Siberia, Central Asia. And there's even a pipeline that goes from the Andaman Sea across Burma into southwestern China, eliminating that choke point through the Straits of Malacca. And China then convened a conference earlier this year, what they called the One Belt, One Road strategy, and they committed another $1 trillion. Well, Their first trillion was already the largest infrastructure project in human history since the United States built the Interstate Highway Program. And so what China is doing is investing several trillion dollars into laying down the infrastructure to transform the world island into the epicenter of geopolitical power, to have an infrastructure so powerful, so integrated, that world power just will automatically shift in China's direction. And the only person in Washington who seemed to understand this was Barack Obama. And during his administration, he came up with a very subtle, absolutely unappreciated, two-part strategy for checking China's rise. First of all, he came up with the idea of two new trade pacts, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that would drain about 40% of world trade, you know, from East Asia, sort of the eastern half of Eurasia, across the Pacific towards the United States. And then he also came up with the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership that would channel about 20% of the world trade from the western end of Eurasia, Western Europe, across the Atlantic towards the United States. So China could build their pipelines and railroads, but the lifeblood of that infrastructure would be drained to America. The second thing he did was he realized that although NATO was strong and it had expanded rapidly since its creation in 1949, that our position in East Asia was weak. We had diverted our strategic forces into the Middle East, and Obama said that, well, now that we've got our fracking and oil production in Canada is booming, we're self-sufficient within this continent for oil, so we don't have a real strategic interest in the Middle East anymore. So continued diversion of our forces to that region is simply not strategic. And so what he did is he renewed those relationships along the other axial end of the Eurasian landmass. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, he persuaded Japan to embrace that fully, that strengthened that relationship. He improved the relationship with South Korea. They got a free trade agreement. He worked very hard at getting the United States access to five military bases inside the Philippines. And he went to Australia, spoke before their parliament in 2011, and got a full Marine Corps brigade based in Darwin, along with some littoral combat ships based in Darwin in the north of Australia, which has readily access to the South China Sea. So Barack Obama rebuilt the U.S. position along the Asia-Pacific littoral. And through these two bold strategic moves, which I consider signs of geopolitical genius, Obama rebuilt the U.S. position. Now, he couldn't stop the long-term shift in the global economy, which is diminishing the U.S. share and all that, but he reinforced the U.S. position, and he slowed this shift of geopolitical power to China.
Mm-hmm. Well, can we say a little bit about the one thing that the Chinese are doing is they are starting the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and they're kind of getting away from the dollar.
Yeah, two things have happened. Not only are they laying down the infrastructure, okay, in gas and oil pipelines, roads and rails, okay, but they're also decided that they needed a vehicle for investment. So they established in 2014, they announced the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank. They opened it in 2016, and it had, at the time of its opening, from its 57 member nations, I think $100 billion in capital, which is about half the size of the World Bank. In other words, very substantial institution. The other thing that China's been doing with its profits is it's slicing through those circles of steel that the United States has built around the world island. China has built seven military bases in the South China Sea, and it also spent $200 billion to transform a sleepy fishing village in Pakistan on the Arabian Sea into a modern port that's just 300 miles from the mouth of the Persian Gulf. And then 2 years ago with Pakistan, they launched a $46 billion road, rail, pipeline corridor from western China down to this sleepy Pakistani port, now a modern port at Gwadar, Pakistan. And then last year, they got the rights to open a military base in Djibouti at the mouth of the Red Sea. So China is slicing through our circles of steel that we've had around the Eurasian landmass.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry to say our membership drive precludes us. We're going to have to sort of end on that note. I might say that your book ends up with a very interesting chapter on the dynamics of U.S. decline, and you present five scenarios for the end of the American century, which are really fascinating reading. And so this book, I really recommend it. We've been talking with Alfred McCoy, author of it. We've been talking about his book just out, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. So, Professor McCoy, thank you very much for being with us.
They're lovely being on. Thank you for such great questions.
And now I think we're going to go out to the membership room and see how we are doing. How's it going out there?
Hi, Pear. Interesting show. This is Ken here. I'm with my friend Lynn, and this is our fall membership drive at KBOO Community Radio. And it's time to call. If you've been on the hook here and thinking about becoming a member, there's no better time than this beautiful, almost fall-like morning. 877-500-5266.
Or KBOO.FM online, because we know we have lots and lots and lots of people who are listening online these days. We love it. Welcome to you all, and come on down and become members. All is better when you do. And also, if you call today, we're having a drawing every day for a fabulous prize of some sort. And today's drawing fulfills your medical and recreational cannabis needs. You can win a $200 gift certificate from Jane PDX in Portland. And we're offering a new prize every day, but that's what is happening today. Just give a call to 877-500-5266 and be entered to win.
And Lynn, one of the things we've been talking about this morning is sustaining membership. That's where you give a monthly amount, and we can take that out through credit card, debit card, or electronic fund transfer from your banking account. And we've been talking specifically, since it is a very fall-like morning, I guess we're a day away from the winter solstice, or the fall equinox, that's right, a day away from that. So it was a very cool morning. We have this wonderful KBOO hoodie with the logo on the front, and a special edition. We have it on the back now, too, so you can show people in front of you and back of you your pride in being a KBOO member. It's for a sustaining membership of $25 a month that gets you to this beautiful warm hoodie. Plus, you get entered into the drawing to win the $200 gift certificate from Jane PDX for medical and recreational cannabis.
It's a win-win situation, but what you really get is the knowledge that this amazing institution, this place where we can interview folks like Alfred McCoy and keep this sort of thing going. KBOO.FM or 877-500-5266. So what you really get, you can get all these great gifts, but you get the satisfaction of knowing you're helping to continue this amazing institution. Aiken?
I know if you're listening now. In fact, Lynn, people out there, they like programming like Pears and Teresa's Press Watch, Pears Fight the Empire, and guests like Alfred McCoy. His book is In the Shadows of the American Century. I just found out, Lynn, that we have five copies of that also for membership, and I think that would be $10 a month sustaining membership.
Excellent.
So if you like what you heard about McCoy's, he's a history professor at the University of Wisconsin, and he was talking quite a bit about global power, but also, there it is. So it is $60 or $10 a month. Or that's actually $5
a month. Do the math, baby. Five.
Right. Okay. I can't do math anymore.
I know.
Dependent on a calculator. But if you want to call up and correct me too, you can do that at 877-500-5266 or online at kbo.fm.
Yeah, Teresa Mitchell was just calling Alfred McCoy the journalist. He also wrote The Politics of Heroin. But what we've got for you this morning is In the Shadows of the American Century for a $5 a month sustaining membership, or put the whole $60 down at one time. And you would be entered into the drawing for Jane PDX, a $200 gift certificate from Jane PDX in Portland. So it fulfills all your medical and recreational marijuana needs. And, you know, then you could get a nice book to read.
A hoodie, if you'd like that, $25 a month.
The fact that you are a member of KBOO, it really feels better when you're a member. 877-500-5266. We are grateful for your membership. The more, the merrier. I've had people come up to me and say, you know, I'm real tired of, well, we don't really have time for the story. I've got a story that will be coming up soon, and it's a really good one. And 877-500-5266. Call now. Now is the time. Just do it. Don't think about anything else. 877-500-5266 or KBOO.FM.
All right, don't go away. Lynn's story coming right up here on the Boo, KBOO Portland, a minute before 10 o'clock. You are listening to the exciting Thursday morning programming where we've got Flashpoints at 10:15 with your host, Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, Between the Covers, Today Sounds Great, David Naiman will welcome Portland novelist Peter Rock. Gotta love that name. And his book, Spells, A Novel with Photographs. It explores the relationship between dreams and waking life, the head and the heart, the living and the dead. That is coming up at 11 this morning. Up next, it is Air Cascadia. Chris Andre is your host with headlines, interviews, and commentary coming right up. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved during this fall membership drive. Call 877-500-KBOO or go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO would like to give a special thanks to our local community partner who donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by the Roxy, located at 1121 Southwest Stark Street in Portland. Breakfast is served any time at this 24-hour diner. Lunch was provided by Stupid Burger, located at 3441 North Vancouver Avenue in Portland, Oregon, 97227. Gourmet burgers, hot dogs, and fried fare from a yellow trailer. Dinner was provided by Tamale Boy Restaurant, Truck, and Catering with three locations in Portland. Go to tamaleboy.com for more info. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-